You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And on this hour of the Made of Clay Report, our guest is Luke Keller. Welcome, Luke.
Thank you, Eric. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. So, Luke, the way we begin the show is with the question, who are you? What do we need to know? What labels, vignettes, stories, qualities, what do we need to know?
I am somebody who is really inspired by high places and remote places.
Uh-huh.
And also, I am fascinated with origins. And those two things sort of permeate my professional and personal life. And I continue to explore them, but...
Right. Okay. So what I'm envisioning here is you are a person who likes perspective, and the further out or back where you're kind of encircled either by yourself without a lot of else, other stuff around, that's where you're happy.
That's where I'm happy, but I'm also happy with the journey getting to places like that. And I mean, physically and spiritually. So I've in my past been a mountaineer climber. I still like to go climb mountains, though not quite as technically as in the past.
Uh-huh.
I'm a newly licensed pilot, a lifelong dream of mine. And I'm an astronomer, so I look into the universe as well to great distances.
Wow. And we're going to cut to music, but I'm going to want to come back to this and ask you how you've discovered this about yourself. But let's you brought a piece of music by Michael Hedges because it's there. Do you want to say something about that before we play it or after?
I'll say before. Michael Hedges is one of my favorite musicians, and this is a piece from a film soundtrack about the Japanese explorer Naomi Uemura, who was famous for doing adventures like climbing some of the tallest mountains in the world solo. And he unfortunately disappeared on Denali, 1984, and this was a film made of his life, and the soundtrack is just fabulous.
Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Luke Keller. So, Luke, how did you either come to discover that you were inclined to these extreme places, these journeys to these isolated places, or how did you, well, yeah, what launched you, as it were?
Well, I grew up in Alaska, for one thing, and when I was born, my parents lived in a small village called Shagaluk on the lower Yukon. So I grew up thinking that that everything was remote.
Right.
My parents tell me that I noticed airplanes as soon as I could notice things, and very shortly after that, I noticed the stars. And so that landscape is very compelling to me as home.
Yes.
I grew up in seeing the Alaska Range, some of the tallest mountains on the continent, and just really was always very inspired by that, and also by surviving in that environment.
How did your parents live? What was your growing up like?
When we lived in the bush, we were in the bush of Alaska in small villages until I was in kindergarten. Both my parents went to Alaska shortly after college to find adventure in the early 1960s. Dad is a Episcopal priest, and he was the priest of the small village that we lived in.
Wow.
And my mother at the time was working as a speech therapist in Anchorage, the largest city. They met when my dad visited Anchorage at one point and then moved together into the village. So I grew up with Dad hunting with the elders, with the men, and thought everybody ate moose. And we got our groceries once a year on a barge that came up the Yukon River. So it was a very, in some ways it sounds exotic now, but I grew up with that being the norm, but that being normal.
Right. It was a practical solution to a practical problem.
Yeah, so the remoteness, going out into the wilderness, just was what we did as a family.
Mm-hmm. So where did you go then next?
We had quite a journey physically as a family. When I was 5 years old, we moved to Long Island, New York, and my dad went to NYU to go to graduate school. Lived here for 2 years. And then we went back to Alaska. In both directions, we drove in a VW microbus all the way from Alaska to New York and back again.
And what years were those?
Those were 1972 and 3.
Wow.
And got to see the big city, but got to see the whole country on the way to and from. And then when we returned to Alaska, we were in Fairbanks, which is one of the larger cities. But we continued to go into the wilderness together as family. Spent a lot of time in Denali National Park. And which it was called at the time, it was called McKinley Park.
Right, Mount McKinley and McKinley. Yeah.
Yep. And of course, largest number of private aircraft per capita in that state, just because of the remoteness
distances.
And distances.
Sure.
And
sure.
So those were things that were always very, were at first normal, and then when we moved in high school, we moved to Arizona. And then those things weren't there anymore.
Right.
There were certainly mountains, and I have a great love for the Southwest as a result of being attuned to the wilderness and to that environment. I quickly fell in love with the environment in the desert.
But it's a completely visually different environment.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, as well as all the critters and stuff that come with it.
Yeah. They're both exotic places. People often wonder whether it was a difficult thing to move from, you know, cold, remote place to a hot, more populated place and dry.
Uh-huh.
But they were exotic in some of the same ways. Like when it was cold in Alaska, we just wore warm clothes and went out and played in the yard. And when
it was
hot,
just your life. Yeah.
Exactly. And there were wolves and bears and things that could be scary. But then in Arizona, there were tarantulas and scorpions and rattlesnakes, which we thought were kind of crazy and exotic as well.
Right. So, yeah. And on some level, they are.
They are. And unfortunately, actually, they're all of those things aren't. It's not really common to see any of them. It's actually quite a treat.
Right. So is this just the habit that you have lived? Or when did this become a kind of a stance?
Well, everywhere I've lived, and this is largely, I think, a lesson my parents taught, I've always really tried to live in the environment, to live with the people that we were around. One of the things that my mom tells me is that a funny story. When we were in Tanana, Alaska, also on the Yukon, I came racing inside with my best friend at the time, and I said, "Mom, you tell him I'm Indian." I thought I was one of the Athabascan people because those were my friends and those were my peers.
And you were them and they were you.
That's what I thought when I was 4.5 years old. But it continued, and I've since I felt so at home in the wilderness and in high places, when we moved to the desert, we hiked in the mountains. I ended up in college in Tucson, Arizona, hooked up with friends almost immediately who liked the same kinds of things. And so we're spending a lot of time in the wilderness, and always is a way for me to sort of recenter and recuperate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how do you bring people into your world in close relationship?
I love to communicate and teach. Uh-huh. And I noticed that at a very young age. I have an almost pathological phobia of being misunderstood and about anything.
So you want to correct when you see misunderstanding happening. You want to address it right away.
That makes me a pretty good teacher, if I say so, but it can be kind of a handicap as well. But that's...
As you learn your skill, it can be a really off-putting thing, but it's also out of a desire.
Yes. So... And bringing, I also enjoy bringing people into these areas which are so compelling for me.
Sure.
And so it's been, in some ways, a sort of growing experience for me to learn from others and also to teach others. As soon as I started rock climbing, for example, mm-hmm. I started teaching rock climbing learning it with friends Then, of course, I've always been interested in... I was interested in science as a young kid. I was just barely old enough to watch the landing on the moon. And I wanted to be an astronaut, of course. What little kid didn't at the time who saw that? But I never was far from science after that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you describe, you know, once you've learned something, you want to teach it to somebody else. And what I'm seeing, having grown up on a subsistence farm, is that, you know, parents and people can only invest in teaching one or two children, and the other children teach the other children, and that's how things get passed on. And I'm wondering, is that part of the root or the foundation of your having grown up in an isolated setting?
It was very much so, but not so much with my siblings. I have two younger brothers and an older sister who is deceased now. But we learned from other people in the community in that way.
And then you pass on. Yeah,
exactly.
It's a pattern. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Cool. And how does it translate into your formal teaching?
Well, it has translated in that I very often see teaching as helping my students develop their intuition, to develop their physical intuition often, because I teach physics and physical science. So it's important to me for people to see not just a description, or hear not just a description, but to understand how we came to know these things and how these are related to our observations and experiences of the universe, of the world.
And of our bodies in the world.
Exactly, yes.
So that is fascinating, because I think having grown up on a farm and worked with animals on the farm and equipment and stuff, you really have to know your body and its strengths and weaknesses and its limitations. And you need to know read the movements of the other animals, whether you're hunting them or hurting them or whatever. How do you do that? Well, I mean, what are some examples of where you've kind of helped students to kind of make the connections?
Well, so for example, I've taught climbing. And of course, that's a physical activity where you have to know your body and
does that accompany your physics class? I mean,
It does, yes, because in physics, for example, if we're talking about the force of gravity, everybody has vast experience with the force of gravity. Yep. We live with it every day, but we don't think about it. And so the physics of gravity seems foreign when many students are first introduced to the language, the physics language that we use. And so what I try to do is to say, this is a language like any other. And when we begin to get the vocabulary and the syntax and understand that you're describing your experience in a different language, I think that that's my approach. And
make them conscious of the language they're already speaking and help them to learn to translate into the other language.
Right. To say that you come to this class with a vast amount of relevant experience and knowledge.
Right.
And we're going to focus that in ways that you may not be familiar with. But it's the unfamiliarity that can be frustrating and not actually the material itself.
Right. Right. And so how do you, when they react to this connection, what do they react to elevations? Do they react to strength in their hands or feet? What are they reacting to as they're learning?
Well, reactions come from fear mm-hmm. of what's unfamiliar. And so in the example of climbing, we're afraid of falling. And if we're not, in my opinion, we shouldn't be doing it because keeps us aware of the danger, which is mm-hmm. which is there,
and the knowledge of our limits may not be accurate,
right?
But our limits are
yes. So then it's a matter of in climbing, it's really a matter of teaching people to be in equilibrium. People think that they need to use a lot of strength in order to climb, and in fact, you don't need a lot of strength to climb. And if you look in the media, the people who are famous for climbing are never really big, built up, muscular people. They can be.
Right.
In fact, any body type can be a good climber, but it's a matter of conserving energy rather than using energy.
Balanced
and being centered and being aware very acutely of your surroundings and the details right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then in physics, it's the same thing. It's paying attention to detail. It's paying attention to things that you have been taking for granted your whole life and then trying to describe them in a consistent language.
So as they become more self-aware, what do they run into in trying to make the translation to written or formulaic math?
I think in any learning, the biggest barrier is certain knowledge. Is you already think you know.
Okay.
And it's very difficult, and that part of my job as a teacher in all areas is to gently to gently show students that what they know is not may not be complete, and in fact sometimes may be not wrong but a misconception,
or it may lead them in ways that are not helpful.
Right. Yeah. So for example, the famous Galileo experiment where you drop a light ball and a heavy ball and they fall at the same acceleration, hit the ground at the same time, can seem kind of counterintuitive. We all hear that example, I mm-hmm. think, a lot, but it can be seem very counterintuitive because the big ball feels heavier. It should be pulled mm-hmm. to the ground more by gravity. And in fact, it is, but it doesn't accelerate more than the light ball. And so coming to terms with what we think we understand about the universe based on our own observations mm-hmm. and then putting that together with something that seems outside of that experience but is nevertheless related.
Right. Right. I mean, in a certain sense, you're teaching them how to distrust themselves.
Yeah, so to be skeptical.
Yeah. And we are raised in a culture where our ability to do things with certain measure of certainty is what we tend to get rewarded for,
yeah.
rather than being rewarded for our openness to being able to adapt to things that we never could have known. And yet the more useful skill on the life cycle is the latter.
Yes, very much. One of the things that I'm constantly working with my physics students, whether they're introductory students or physics majors, mm-hmm. is physics is not math.
Right.
It seems like it is, and it seems very mathematical, but math is a language that we use to do physics.
It is a language
yes.
of physics, but it is not physics.
Yes. Yes. And so the calculation is not the physics. Often the calculation is what people are feeling uncertain about. And so I often will say to a student who asks for help, "Oh, I see that you're having a challenge with math here, and you're not uh-huh. having a challenge with physics. It appears to me that you understand the physics, so let's work on the math." Or you appear to be just fine with the math, but there's a physical detail that maybe we should discuss more.
And I would imagine that their response to you would be, "Thank you."
Well, not immediately, but I mean,
you're helping. You're there's a level of appreciation that yeah, I didn't always, experience as a student.
Yeah, I certainly have experienced that as a student. And I, one of the things that I do with students, whether we're doing outdoor activities or whether we're doing physics or astronomy or math, is to remind them that I was where they are, and I remember it very clearly, and I remember this frustration, and it's part of the process.
Yeah. And to be remembered is to be put together again.
Right.
And that's a beautiful concept. Let's take a musical break. Where should we go next?
One of my favorite bands is the Outback, and this is from the album Baka. It is a guitar and didgeridoo, and the first time I heard this, I was amazed at how the didgeridoo could be used. I had heard it, of course, but it can be used as both a melodic and a percussion instrument at the same time. And this this artist, Graham Wiggins, Dr. Didge, he's called, is just amazing.
Okie doke, here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Luke Keller. So, Luke, given your experiences in Alaska, in the Southwest, what brought you to Ithaca and what keeps you here?
Well, between the Southwest and Ithaca, I spent almost 10 years in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And I was in, it made more sense than
I'm gonna
say
you
Austin, might think.
But
well, it was Austin. My mother's side of the family is from Texas since the mid-19th century. So I had been to Texas to see grandparents and family. But I went to graduate school in Austin and met my wife, Sherry, in Austin. She was also in graduate school there in English. And we bonded because, in part, because she's from Minnesota and I'm from Alaska, and we didn't get winter down there. And we were desperate for it. We were desperate for four seasons instead of two.
Right.
So when it came time for us to do the job searches, we had since we were both in academia, which is the two-body problem, we agreed that the first one who got a promising academic job or a job that we wanted to pursue as a career in a place that we both really wanted to live, we would take that. And so I got a postdoc at Cornell. Mm-hmm. And we loved the idea of Central New York. And she got a job working at Ithaca College in their publications department in Alumni Hall. She's an editor.
Uh-huh.
So we were here. We loved it. Fell in love almost immediately. And about 4 years into my work at Cornell, a job opened up at Ithaca on the Faculty of Physics, which I applied for and got. So then we had the tenure track job that would last at the college. And then we flip-flopped. So Sherry worked at Cornell Press for a while. Then she has since opened a freelance editing and writing business. And I'm at Ithaca College. We just both fell in love with the area, all of the things that we enjoy doing, the winter sports, that we're both mm-hmm. cross-country mm-hmm. skiers. The Adirondacks are now one of my favorite places on the planet. Because there's that vertical relief that I yep. love so much. And yep. Sherry grew up on lakes in Minnesota, and it's got those as well. Yep. So, and of course the Finger Lakes. So the environment is just fantastic. We just, I daily, just marvel at the view as I drive. I really am just mm-hmm. thankful daily for the place that we live. Our daughter was born in 2003, and, we live in Dryden mm-hmm. and, she's getting that bug as well. So enjoys the outdoors and, that so we stay because we feel like we belong here. We've got good friends and work that we care about.
How many years have you been here?
We moved here in 99.
Okay.
So yeah. I've been at Ithaca College now for 13 years, which is crazy because it's just been a whirlwind right. of really great work and
right,
people.
Right. And you have been able to navigate here. What so many people come here and then have to leave for someplace else, or
yeah.
they end up living apart as a couple or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, we had 3 weeks apart.
Uh-huh.
We were pretty lucky.
Yeah. 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 So this may be, you may have lived here as long as you've lived anywhere.
That's right.
So how has that changed your, or has that had an impact on your perspective to be, in a sense, local for that long?
It's funny. I haven't really thought about it in those terms. It seems like the place that we belong.
Uh-huh.
We definitely make make a point of going other places that are where we can enjoy the landscapes that we like. And then I have gone on many trips to climb mountains, for example. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things I've ever gotten paid for while I was a postdoc at Cornell was to go to the Andes and climb mountains and install weather stations to, we were looking for a possible site for a new telescope, astronomical telescope.
Right.
And I felt like I was in a National Geographic special all the time. You know, just amazing environment, exactly where I wanted to be, doing the things that I love, astronomy and being in the mountains. And so, yeah, we take the advantage of traveling when we can. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it really seems to make a lot of sense here. We have not been tempted to leave.
Wow. No, it's just, just having known a lot of people, this is one of the few places where in upstate New York where the population has doubled in the last 60 years, you know, and so there are lots of people who've come in and stayed, and most of that in growth isn't students, it's permanent residents, even mm-hmm. though student population grew a lot. But, you know, there's a steady pathway between Ithaca and Austin, you know, back and forth and back and forth. And there's steady pathways between Minnesota and here. And I'm less aware of them between Alaska and here. But, yeah, it's an interesting kind of compromise. Yeah,
I occasionally meet Alaskans here. I have a few students from Alaska. Yeah,
I see a few license plates every once in a while.
Yeah.
So how have you changed over the last 14 years? Or actually, no, it's the last, let me do my math, 17 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Your daughter's 14. Or, yeah,
she's 12 now. 12. It's been quite a while. Yeah. I have changed as a teacher, I think, most profoundly. And I had one of these experiences, this instantaneous experience that changed my life and my work. I have a colleague, Bodie Rogers, who when we were both hired at the same time in 2003, and he had a lot of experience with methods of teaching physics that I had never really experienced. And one day he asked for me to do an experiment. He said, imagine what would happen in your classroom if there were no students in the room. And I thought for a minute and I realized, wow, almost nothing would change, except that maybe there wouldn't be some questions and answers. In other words, I do an awful lot of talking and showing.
It's all performance.
It's a performance. We call it the sage on a stage.
Yep. Yep.
And there's nothing wrong with the lecture format in and of itself, but especially for something like physics, which has so many aspects where you have to do it to really learn it. That format isn't as effective. And it was the first time I had ever thought that, because I at that point I'd had lots of kudos for my teaching and I had a lot of experience teaching and felt very confident in my teaching. And so it was one of those moments where I realized, wow, I have so much to learn about something that I thought I was so experienced at. It was kind of exciting. I never felt like, wow, what's wrong with me? I just felt like that this world had been opened up that I didn't really, you know, I kind of thought I had the universe figured out in that corner.
Right. But what he's asking you to do is to value the other's experience as much as your own.
Right. And in it's obvious to us in something like rock climbing or flying an airplane or learning a foreign language that you cannot learn how to do it without doing it.
Right.
But there are some subjects where, and unfortunately, I think a lot of in college especially, where we think that we can just learn by listening to somebody who knows a lot. And that is appropriate in many instances, and I still lecture sometimes. I think it's still a good way it's a great way to communicate a lot of information in a short period of time, but it isn't necessarily the best way for us, at least in physics, to for students to learn because they're not doing it themselves.
So what actually has changed and what do you do differently?
What I do differently is I check in with the students a lot more and in a much more formal way instead of asking, are there any questions? I'm famous now for saying, are there any questions? And you know what the next thing is going to be. If you don't have questions, I'm going to have questions for you. So the lectures are much more sporadic. I do mini lecture. I've adopted some techniques that people have been using for several decades now in physics research that's based on, or physics teaching that's based on research, just showing that rather than giving the students a lot of information and then a homework problem for them to go work on by themselves, I give them the problem in class.
Right.
That's when they need me. That's right. When they need their teacher, is when they're struggling with the material and actually
in real
doing
time.
It. So we're trying to move the gathering of information to the outside. They're good at reading. They're good at finding information, especially when they're guided to find the information I think they need, and then bring that to class, and then let's apply it together. So I do a lot more. It's not more student-centered in class now than it was. It was more professor-centered when I was not aware of this.
And is there any loss of self in that? I mean, how is there any loss to you, or is this all gain? I mean, how does it feel different now?
I find it very liberating. It can be very jarring to the system because it's harder to plan what's going to happen in class. Because at first I had, you know, ways that I taught the course, and I would come in prepared and then realize we're just not ready to continue the way I had planned. Or wow, they're so ready, I have to do what I was going to do next time.
Right.
And so but I find that liberating. I find it wonderful when I check in with the students and realize that we're good to go, we just go, we just move on.
Right. And I guess I would find that, and I'm going to put that in my language, and my background is in kind of spirituality, and I'm an ordained minister and chaplain and whatnot. you have learned to know that you are prepared, whether you have a lesson or not. And being prepared means you are seeing where other people are and responding to that in real time and trusting that you can work it out. That's life.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, that's emotionally and intellectually and physically being present to life. We oftentimes don't model that, let alone, or teach it for students in higher education.
Yeah, and I've realized that, I like how you articulated that, because I've realized that some of the most important teaching that I do is to students who are not going to be scientists,
mm-hmm.
To teach them science and to be the teacher of their science course, because that lesson is just as important. That lesson is important for everyone.
Right, and what do they need to walk away from as a person conversant in science? Proficient in science.
Proficient in science means understanding how science works and what people do when they do science. It's an activity. It's mm-hmm. not a subject. It's not a body of knowledge as much as an activity. And professional scientists commonly say, let's do science, or we're doing science.
Right.
And so that's one of the most important lessons I can think of, that students know the nature of science, that when they read about a scientific discovery or a change in what we know based on scientific work, that they understand what happened behind the scenes so that they can make a decision. Because sometimes when you hear about science in the news, it's often a lesson that will become what you should eat or not eat, or how you should...
A conclusion.
Exactly.
Or a theory.
Or yes.
Right.
And to know that that there is this process, that a theory... the word theory is used differently in common speech than it is in science. And mm-hmm. so a theory to a scientist is the pinnacle of our work. If I have a theory that we call good because it is making accurate predictions about future observations that then bear out according to, accurately.
Right.
That's what science, that's what we're trying to mm-hmm. do. We're mm-hmm. explaining what we observe. And so for students to understand that in science there's no such thing as just a theory.
Right.
You can have just a hypothesis, and I think that's what people mean often.
Right. I'm actually wanting to walk this into a more spiritual or related. I don't know how you've continued this or whether you, but I've hosted several times over the years conversations between scientists, Nobel Prize winners, and other scientists of many different accolades and successes and practices, to compare the practice of science with the practice of faith, because you know theory and theology are analogous, mm-hmm. but the practice of science is analogous to faith in spiritual terms. It's how you engage something, embrace it, try to understand it intellectually, emotionally, physically, to interact with it, which is very much what you're describing. And yet we and that brings the whole person into play. But we do have this dismissive attitude towards theology or towards religion, and we have a dismissive attitude in some ways towards theory, you know, and then mm-hmm. you've highlighted that. Do you ever make those kinds of connections in class, or is that just too far out?
I do make those connections in class. In fact, I teach a freshman seminar, which is about the nature of science, uh-huh. in which we talk very much about this, and how science is one way of learning about the universe. It's very successful when we can make observations and measurements.
And replicate them.
It is not the only way, nor is it the only accurate way, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or even precise way of knowing about nature and the universe. And so I bring them back to the process. In fact, I make kind of a shtick about saying we all know about the scientific method, right? But let's deconstruct it, and we'll build it back up again. It'll have all the same parts, but it'll be the scientific process rather, because a method sounds like a recipe.
Right.
And it's a process very much in the same way that a spiritual practice is a process, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and that growth, a spiritual growth, is a process.
Right. And this would be a conversation for another time, but I think there are many practices that are around faith that you can also test that we just haven't taken the time to do, in terms of the perception and engagement and cause and effect and all sorts mm-hmm. of
yeah.
and erroneous assumptions in all of those, as well as valid, you know, experiences and how we construct those. let's take a break for some music. What would you like to go to next?
We talked about Texas, so let's do quick, slow.
Okie doke.
This is a selection from Dale Watson, who's a country western singer, and I love his music because it reminds me of old time country music. So Kitty Wells, Willie Nelson, Patsy Cline,
yeah,
the old fashioned. He's
not very, the '50s, but the '60s.
Right. He's very much in the music scene now in Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And this one is about the Texas two-step.
Okay, here we go.
Quick, slow. She asked me to dance, said I don't know how. She took me by my hand, said I'll show you now. My heart was beating fast when I hit that floor. She whispered in my ear, soft and low. Quick, slow.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Luke Keller. So that song has even more resonance, as you were talking while we were playing it, for your family and music. Tell me a bit about dance and Texas.
Yeah, so my family, my mother's side is Texan, and I spent time not just during grad school, but before visiting Texas. My grandmother, Betty Casey, literally wrote the book on Texas folk dancing in the 1980s and would not have a grandson who didn't know how to do these dances. And quick, slow are the steps for the two-step, the most common country western dance. And she had us doing polka, schottische, waltz. And so I really have a... That sort of feeds my fascination with activities that have both an intellectual component mm-hmm. and a kinesthetic component, and so it's a part of my childhood. We were just always dancing, and in fact, one of the first times that my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, met my grandmother, she got us out on the porch and had us dancing, and then took us to a honky tonk, and that was kind of her test, I think.
And apparently, it all worked.
It all worked out. Yep.
Yeah. Dancing is also a way in which you can kind of you embody movement, like you say, and you're both kind of completely present, but you're completely separate from everything else. So it's almost like a meditation.
It is very much.
I want to go back and ask you a little bit more about, you're teaching a first year seminar, first year course.
Yes.
How do your students react to your breaking apart the scientific method and the calling of and making it the scientific process? How do they receive that, and how do they employ it in their lives, or can you tell?
I would love to know how they employ it in their lives after.
Sure.
One of the things that I notice is that they're skeptical. They don't believe me. So although I try to make it clear why we're doing what we're doing, the theme of this course, the overarching theme is, how we know what we know.
Right.
Through the process of science. And so I said, we gotta talk about the process, and we can't just take for granted that you had the scientific method in high school, even though you know a lot about it. And so we unpack it by reading case studies, by reading stories, historical stories about how famous theories were developed, like the Big Bang Theory, mm-hmm. or the theory of evolution of species by mm-hmm. natural selection, tectonic theory, and realize that they didn't follow the scientific method the way we've learned it as a recipe.
Right.
More than one people did the work. Sometimes the experiment came before the hypothesis. It's messy. It's
yes.
messy, like most of what humans do. And that's okay. And yet we've learned so much, and we have these ways of explaining what we see in the universe.
Right. Right. And the most important thing from what you just said is probably may not be what most listeners picked up on, but you said they don't believe me. As a teacher, I think probably one of the most critical moments is, how do you respond to a student's not believing you?
I most often respond by asking them to articulate their belief
mm-hmm.
or their understanding. And right. I even put that in my syllabus. I have a rule. Luke's rule is, if you hear me tell you something that is outside of your experience or your understanding and it makes you uneasy, raise your hand. Mm-hmm. We have a discussion to, mm-hmm. to have.
Right. And is the discussion for converting you to the belief, or is the discussion for exploring the disconnect? I mean, I'm leading in that question. I don't mean to be leading. But how is it that you hold on to their disbelief?
I have found that it's easier to, if it's a misconception, I have found it easier to correct a misconception for myself by working through the process myself. And so I'm trying to encourage students to engage that misconception. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, for example, that the moon is up during daylight hours. It is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yet many people do not believe that because they have never seen it. And
yeah.
So what better way to correct that misconception than to imagine a universe where the moon couldn't be up during the day? What would that look like? And the conclusion that the students come to is, it doesn't go around the earth.
Right. It's a stationary place.
Right. And yes. So that's inconsistent with our observation. So we've got to change our theory. We've got
right.
to change our understanding.
Right. 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 And what you're doing is, you're letting the experience speak for itself.
Yes.
You don't have to prove anything.
That's correct. And yeah. since I'm teaching the process of science, it's perfectly appropriate.
Yeah. No. And that's where, but I would say that most of education could be carried out on that basis. It's just that we tend not to give ourselves over to the needs of our students in that very profound sort of way, and trust that the vast resources that we have are sufficient to the needs.
Yeah, I think that's true in many cases. Certainly has been true in my evolution as a teacher. I've come to know that. I do think, though, that there are areas where we have narratives and stories to tell,
mm-hmm.
and it may be best to just tell the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And then react to the story. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in a literature course or something like that. But then in a literature course, at least the ones that I took, and I know my colleagues who teach literature, they're engaging their students with the text.
Right. Yeah, but I'm gonna take something back to you. This telling the story, the we if the moon, we believe, passes around the Earth. That's a story in its most simple, and we have stories about the moon rise and the moon set. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have these stories. So I think we're always telling stories. I mean, we're critters. We can't communicate without telling stories.
Yes.
And I think there's a time when some of the stories are longer and they take up more airtime. Yeah. And some students have stories that are long and take up a lot of airtime in class, because I teach too, but not in an academic setting. Mm-hmm. And being able to know, to trust that the story matters. And then when it ceases, or when it's becoming a tension in the class, to clip it, to try to figure out how to clip it so that you don't lose the respect of each other.
Yeah, the narrative is super important. In fact, I think science at its pinnacle is good storytelling. Mm. And I often will tell the story. I'll say it to my students. I'm just going to tell the story of the origin of the universe from 3.8 billion years ago to now, from beginning to end. Let's just have the story out there, and then we'll go back and ask the question, how do we know this? What mm-hmm. did people do to learn this? Mm-hmm. What was the process?
Yep. And then when you do that kind of storytelling, I've been in a public school where we could do the origin of species right next to the beginning of Genesis. And we could do them in a combined literature and social studies class. I mean, a kind of science and literature class, so that we could actually look at both stories on the quality of evidence and what you would use to analyze the story. And it allows people to use their whole minds.
That's wonderful.
And their whole body. It does not violate any separation of church and state, because you're really teaching critical skills.
One of the best classes I ever had in public school was a class on religion. In high school, I had a world religions course, and it made such an impact. And I think religion ought to be taught in the schools.
Yeah. So we're getting near the end of the hour, and I don't want this to slip away. What do you personally do on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis to restore yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically? How do you take care of yourself, and how do you know when you need to take care of yourself?
The best way has always been to get outside. Mm-hmm. And I ride my bike. Occasionally I run, go for a hike. And doing that with family and friends. So that's one thing. And mm-hmm. I know that when I'm working too hard, or when I'm not giving myself time to decompress, that's a good way to get to the place where I can then say, okay, now what else do I need to do?
So you need that to take the edge off when things have gone over the edge.
Right.
The things you described were all moving through space. They're getting outside, but moving, not getting outside and being still. What is there about the motion that's important to you?
I think that the motion is fun,
uh-huh.
but it also is a slowly changing landscape.
Uh-huh.
That's why I really like riding the bike. It uh-huh. changes fast enough to see things change, but also it's a physical activity that I have to do to sustain.
It's aerobic
that.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I've found I don't ride my bike during the winter when the roads are bad, but I do ride most days in the summer to work and back. And
that's a hefty ride from Dryden to Ithaca College.
Yes, it is. But it's wonderful. You know, it's a 45 minutes to an hour of just moving and I'm thinking. If I drive, I find that I get home still doing work in my head.
Uh-huh.
And that bike ride just kind of lets it transition more to enjoying my
cleans the slate
folks at home and doing the things that we do together there.
What do you do emotionally to take care of yourself?
Music.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit of a musician, self-taught. Took a few guitar lessons, but listening to music. I love music mm-hmm. in all different kinds. The selections that I've chosen for you today really are from my collection, and it's like that. It's, you know, there's hip hop in there. There's classical. I really love classical music of all different kinds. So yeah, music is really, I just put on music and quiet too. I like getting up really early in the morning mm-hmm. before anybody else and just kind of watching the sunrise or just sitting there. I might be thinking already of work, but that the quiet is
right. The quiet is, it's not an agitated thinking. It's a
yeah.
peaceful thinking. Do you still dance?
No, I don't. And my daughter loves to dance, and so that's been fun to dance together. But no, I've thought recently we should get into that because I've enjoyed it so much in the past. When I was in Austin, I did a lot of dancing. I was in a folk dance club, and that was one of those things that I have not punched into in this community.
What do you see in your life when you know you need to go out and take a ride, or you know you need to go out and do, what do you see happening in your routine life?
Usually it's I'm feeling like I'm not accomplishing enough. It's that I have said yes to too many projects, or and I'm not completing them in the time that I or others want.
So you may actually be working faster than normal, but you're not working as fast as you committed yourself to.
Exactly, or that I think I ought to. And often my healing is to realize I don't I'm asking too much of myself, or I just need to set something aside for a while and work on
it's
the
kinda
other
like
things.
It's kind of like my hypothesis was wrong.
Yeah.
About what I might be able to accomplish given a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my weaknesses, which has resulted in lots of really amazing experiences, is saying yes to new and interesting projects when I know I don't have the time to complete them.
Yeah. 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 And you still say yes.
And I still say yes.
And often. You still, and probably you complete more of them than you might have imagined, would be my guess.
Usually, yes. But
you
it does.
Ask a busy person to do something and they usually get it done. But yeah.
Yeah. But every now and then it does kind of pile up.
How do you let something go?
I haven't figured out a good way to answer that question, but often I just let it go. Mm-hmm. I might have to explain if it depends on other people, or if other people are depending, I might have to explain how I can't be involved anymore. But often I just kind of set things aside.
Yeah, it's the, for me, from my knowing of my knowledge of scientists and working with them, the hardest thing is to let something go that's compelling, but you know you cannot do it. And it is a lesson to be learned that it allows other people to take it on and to not expect you and not be hurt by you, to just say clearly, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tough one, though.
It is a tough one.
It's a tough one for pastors, too. And I've been there, done that. You just can't do everything. Luke, it's been a delight to get to know you.
Great getting to know you. Thanks for the questions and for the invitation to join you.
And you want to close with Beastie Boys' Groove Home. So you want to say anything about it before we play?
Yeah, this is Beastie Boys, like many people may not have heard them. I certainly hadn't when I found this album. This
I hadn't
is jazz.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's amazing. And this is, you know, they famously thought saying we have to fight for the right to party. And this is the party. It's amazing.
Okay, here we go. We'll be right back.